Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
It's brought to you, or brought to all of us, by the Interpreter Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to the promotion and study and defense of the scriptures of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The Interpreter Foundation is a nonprofit 501c organization. So any money that goes into donations go into the Interpreter Foundation are totally tax deductible. So we've got a good show here tonight. We're going to bring on a couple gospel scholars to talk to us about the scriptures, and we're going to talk about geek books and geek all. I'll get our geek on. So it'll be fun. Let's see. Let's bring on Matt Bowen. Are you there? You there, Matt?
Aloha, Mark. I'm here.
Aloha, Matt. Good to hear from you. How are you?
Great. Thank you. How are you?
Doing okay. Our regular staple of the show, Steve Densley, is flying back from the Interpreter's Ultimate Egypt tour right now, so he's not on the air with us. And I'm not going to act like I'm not jealous at all of this situation. So, you know, Steve, take your time. You're good. We'll see you next time. And I'm jealous. Okay, I'll get over that. All right, and we've also got a special guest with us today. We've got Egyptologist Dr. Carrie Milstein. Carrie, are you there as well?
I am. How are you?
Oh, this is a treat. I'm doing well.
Aloha, Carrie. Aloha. It's good to talk to you both.
Aloha to everybody. This will be fun.
Yeah.
I want to thank Martin Tanner. He just made sure our phones are running. He's going to sneak out here. Thanks, Martin, for the help. Appreciate that. All right. So we've got hopefully a good show coming up here. I also need to mention our other sponsor. That is LDSAgents.com. LDS Agents is a network of over 2,000 real estate agents who are members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and they are dedicated to helping Latter-day Saints or anyone else who needs their assistance find a good home in a good neighborhood. So if you are in the process of moving or thinking about moving and have, you know, special requirements and needs that you need assistance with, whether it's, you know, a type of home you're going to get, or, you know, you want to be in a certain school district or what have you, you know, go ahead and give LDSAgents.com a try. Look them up. It's LDSAgents.com. You'll be glad you did. Okay, so we've got, starting off, we've got special guest Carrie with us today. And Carrie, you've got a couple books in the works. One of them is it just starting to show up now? It's a book on Isaiah, is that right?
Yeah, yes. Yeah. So it came out in early November. So it's a verse-by-verse commentary on Isaiah.
Okay. What's it called? So we can look for it in the stores.
It's called Learning to Love Isaiah, A Guide and Commentary, I think is the subtitle. I don't remember for sure. But,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. You want to give us, we want to spend, because our Come Follow Me lesson in the second hour, we're going to be talking about Isaiah, or not Isaiah, what am I saying? We'll be talking about the early chapters of Genesis and the book of Moses and the book of Abraham. So we're going to put a lot more time into talking about that as part of the new Come Follow Me curriculum. But what can we expect out of this Isaiah or this Isaiah book? What makes it different than the other Isaiah commentary?
I can give you a short synopsis now, and then maybe when we get closer to Isaiah and Come Follow Me, that's not until like September or something, so it's a long ways away. Yeah. Maybe I can tell you more, but it is basically there are two things I hope to do with this that I haven't seen in other commentaries, and there are some fantastic commentaries by members of the Church of Christ of Latter-day Saints. They're friends and mentors of mine, and they have done great stuff, but I felt like there wasn't any that really did touch on every single verse in Isaiah. So as I read, I'll see things where, whoever the author would talk about this passage and that passage, but there might have been a tricky passage in between the two that was never touched on, and people are still left wondering, okay, I need help. I need a guide through that. And secondly, I find that for the most part, as Latter-day Saints, we focus on millennial or latter-day fulfillments, and we skip earlier or original context and fulfillments. And I feel like we can get a lot more and understand that the messianic or latter-day fulfillments when we understand the original context. And so I try to really focus on here's how it would have been taken in Isaiah's day or maybe Jeremiah's day and then the Savior's day so that then we can more fully understand how all of those things point towards Christ and the last days.
That is something I'm looking forward to greatly. I agree. That's something that just the notion that, you know, what did this mean in the original author's time? What did it mean in Isaiah's time? You know, we don't get as much of that. I think we have to find ourselves going to other non-LDS authors, other scholars, you know, for that. But then we also have to worry about, well, you know, does he know, this other author know about, you know, other factors from, you know, modern revelation? No.
Right, and Joseph Smith translation and so on and so on.
Right, and that's not going to be in there. So I think this should be a nice bridge between the two of those.
I hope so. It's supposed to be user-friendly and guide people through it, so I hope so.
Well, I can't wait to read it. And Christmas is coming up, so Santa, if you're listening,
that's right.
Go ahead and put a couple of copies in my stocking. That'd be great. Let's see, and then you've also go ahead.
Mark, I was going to say, I've been of the view for a long time that we really can't fully get what we need to out of the scriptures unless we do as what Carey's done in this commentary, unless we're really looking at the original context. I think we get better exegesis or interpretation for the present when we really do our homework on the past and really wrestle with how they would have understood these things. And so I think Carey's commentary is really going to really add in an important way to what the work that's already been done on the book of Isaiah.
I hope so. And I have lots of sections on the Book of Mormon in there as well. So I hope it helps with that as well. But thank you.
That'll be great. Yeah. And I totally agree, Matt. That's one of the things that I've tried to focus on with my own researches and my own writings. I've got a couple papers that I'm putting together to talk about that very thing, going back to, you know, what the residents there in, you know, Jerusalem or what have you, you know, what would have they thought? How would have they acted, you know, under those situations? I can't imagine or can't really count how many times I've heard, you know, just as an example, you know, in Sunday school lessons that Alma and Amulek were missionary companions and that they were outgoing door to door, you know, out spreading the word, and I just think, oh, I don't know if that's how that was.
Yeah.
You know, we'd liken it, you know, if you want to use that phrase, liken the scriptures so much that, you know, we almost, you know, water them down or look, you know, we almost change them into something they're not.
Yeah.
So, and then, Carey, you've also got a book coming out in a few months, is it, on the Book of Abraham?
Yeah, in January. It's part of Deseret Books' Let's Talk About series. They're doing a series called Let's Talk About, where they handle some of the issues that people have questions about right now. So far, I think they have Let's Talk About Polygamy, Let's Talk About Mental Health of the Latter-day Saints, and then mine's the third book, Let's Talk About the Book of Abraham.
Oh, terrific. Do you want to give us a little overview on that? Is it also discussing, well, I guess, it, as you said, it talks about some of the more controversial or misunderstood items relating to the Book of Abraham?
Yeah, I try and do so. It's interesting. I try and be somewhat comprehensive, but you can only be somewhat comprehensive because in this series they wanted it to be short. So I was limited in word space. It's a fairly short, very readable book. As a result, it's not very expensive. I think it's $12. I can't remember, but something along those lines. And I think it's very readable. But at the same time, I've tried to talk about all sorts of aspects. So I have some chapters on Abraham's life, on the life of the priest who owned the papyri that Joseph Smith ended up with that had facsimile one on it, and how knowing those things, again, kind of going back to that original context, how knowing those things can help us understand everything else about it. I talk about how, you know, from Napoleon's invasion to Kirtland, how, you know, the papyri get to Joseph Smith. And then some time on Joseph Smith translating it, publishing it, and how it ends up being canonized. I've got a chapter in there where we looked at different methods of knowing what we call epistemology, and comparing the academic method and the revelatory method and their strengths, and what each one is designed to help us learn, and talking about how we should combine them. And then I start going through some of the issues, like the questions, how, what did Joseph Smith translate? How did he translate it? How do the grammar and alphabet of the Egyptian language and those kinds of things play into it? And then as we look at those, we look at, okay, what can the academic method tell us regarding this? And what can the revelatory method tell us regarding this? And we look at, you know, the ancient setting of the Book of Abraham and the facsimiles and so on, and address some of the issues and questions people have with that. In each case, I'm trying to be just really forthright and frank and saying, okay, a non-believer might take it this way and someone else might take it this way. And then I get the last chapter. I felt for a long time like we are doing all of us a disservice if we keep talking about issues surrounding the text and never talk about the text. That much of the power and ability to learn, both in terms of the academic method and the revelatory method, depends upon the text of the Book of Abraham, and I think we just keep kind of ignoring that. And so I have a chapter saying, here are some of the doctrines that we get from the Book of Abraham, and encouraging people to spend their time as well as they're looking at other sources for learning about the Book of Abraham, look to the Book of Abraham itself for learning about the Book of Abraham.
I like that. That's a smart way to go. I think, yeah, you're absolutely right. So much ink has been spilled about, you know, what it is or what it isn't, what the relationship to the facsimiles are to the papyrus and the Book of Abraham, the translation, and all of that, and both on the side of faithful Latter-day Saints and the critics of the church. It'll be nice to get, you know, a good emphasis on what the text actually says.
Yeah,
it's interesting to me.
I hope that it accomplishes that. And I should say, I want to compliment Deseret Book in helping me with this book. You know, they approached me. They said we'd like it to be part of this series. And I said, okay, this is a tricky issue and it's a complex issue. I need some really good reviewers.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'd like someone who is absolutely an expert on its ancient setting, someone who is absolutely an expert on the 19th century setting of it, going into the 20th century setting, and then someone who is an expert on the theology and doctrine behind it. And they got me three of the best people, one on each of those that you could ever imagine. And typically in a review like this, you don't know who the reviewer is, and they don't know who they're reviewing. In Book of Abraham, Latter-day Saint circles, it's pretty easy to tell who's writing what, because there aren't very many of us, and pretty soon you're like, okay, I know this. All three reviewers independently, without telling any of the others they were doing this, they didn't know who each other was. They approached Ezra Book and they said, you know what, I want this book to be as good as possible. I would be fine with you telling Kerry that I am the reviewer and having him approach me, and we can work out together how to make this part better or that part better. And so with each of the three did approach me and helped me hammer out you know, making sure we got it absolutely right and that there wasn't anything incorrect in there and how to approach it and so on. And it's a much better book because it had such really good, and they really were some of the best people for each of those areas that you could imagine, and they put a lot of work into helping me make it better. I'm really grateful for that, and I think it is much better for their input.
That is great. I'm looking forward to this even more now. What have you learned that was new as you put this book together? What surprised you?
I don't know if there were huge surprises. It was a subject that I knew fairly well, but I feel like I did come to know better, probably the area that I came to know better than I had before, so I felt like I had a much better grasp on it, was going through kind of the historical sources for Joseph's translation of it, and by that I mean both the eyewitness and second-hand accounts, but also the documents such as the grammar and alphabet, and the Egyptian alphabet and the Book of Abraham manuscripts and so on, all those earlier manuscripts that I'd spent a lot of time on before, but I spent a whole lot more on it with this, and I feel like I had a much better grasp of what they were doing. And the interesting thing is, well, not what they were doing, but what's on the document. And the interesting thing is that the better you know the documents, the less you can figure out what in the world they were doing. It becomes really clear that there is no theory from a believer or non-believer. I haven't seen any theories put out there that can fully explain it. I do think that there's some people who are getting closer. I know like Mike McKay and Dan Belknap are working on some things and so on. They're coming up with some theories that I think are pretty interesting and may get us closer to explaining it. But really, right now, there is no theory that can account for all of the data. And that was the part that to me was maybe the most surprising, that we have people that are making very strong conclusions to the point where they will leave the church based on data that can't yield conclusions. So they're making conclusions from inconclusive data, inconclusive information, and that's just kind of, it's sad and shocking to me that we are putting so much faith in a process that can't yield results.
Yeah, but unfortunately it happens probably far too often with just matters of things we don't understand in church history or the production of scripture. It's easy to, you know, get a 30-second snippet or a headline and just run with that instead of actually doing the research. And I think that's where, you know, your work and the work of other scholars, you know, is gonna pay off, hopefully.
I hope so. And that is one of the things that I've I think I say this in the book, and I've started to say it more and more, that we're dealing with a lot of complex things. We're dealing with Abraham, who is a complex person living in a complex time and living in a number of cultures. We're dealing with documents that are from a complex period of Egyptian history. We're dealing with things that Joseph Smith is doing in the revelatory process that we don't fully understand. I don't understand a prophetic revelatory process. I don't understand some of the things that they were doing in their kind of experiments with that grammar. There are a whole lot of things that we don't understand, but they're all complex. And everything that you read that is aimed at casting doubt on the Book of Abraham is cast in really simplistic terms, really, really simplistic. And I'm trying to tell people, if it's simplistic, don't trust it. It can't be accurate if it's simplistic. There's no way that all of these complex things can come out that simply. If you really want to know about this, you need to spend some time and revel in the complexity. Mm-hmm. I'm grateful for a complex person like Abraham, who lived in several different societies. I'm grateful for all that, and that I can put some time into it, because when we put time into it, then we can get great stuff out of it. And that's when we can start to really get the most out of both the academic and the revelatory method. Whereas if we just believe a simplistic little soundbite, then of course we're going to get fooled.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. One of the things that I think people will fluctuate in is just absolutes. They will, you know, believe that the Book of Abraham, you know, needed to have been written by Abraham himself, and then, you know, that bit of papyri ended up in Joseph Smith's hands. Or on the other end, you know, that Joseph Smith just was you know, cribbing stuff out of Genesis and just made the whole thing up. And there's, you know, the truth isn't on either of those extremes. It's, you know, it's somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
And I think that the work to get people to, you know, think a little more critically and to do a little more, you know, deep thinking about it and more, what's the word I'm looking for? I guess less relying on our own assumptions and, you know, be willing to accept, what comes out as, you know, as a solution instead of just, you know, relying on these assumptions. It's a lot of work, is what I'm trying to say.
It is. It is. And I do think that is one of the biggest problems we've had with Book of Abraham studies is assumptions, unnoticed assumptions. That has caused a tremendous amount of problems. So I try and be upfront. It's really important to me to just say, let's be upfront about what assumptions we bring into this, what mindsets we bring in, what skills are necessary. Let's not let people pretend like one kind of assumption is more objective than another or something along those lines. And then we can really look into it.
Yeah, I agree.
I feel like if someone, for example, the chapter where we go through some of the Egyptian alphabet stuff, that really is complex stuff. But I hope I've been able to put it in an understandable way where people can start to see things like, well, you know, some of these characters are not from anywhere on the papyri. Some of them seem to be from the Book of Mormon characters document. Some of them seem to be from some stuff they were doing with the Adamic language. Some of them seem to be maybe just made up, and then others are taken from the papyri, sometimes in an order, sometimes jumping around. And when you see all that, you say, okay, none of these simple theories that he's translating, he's making this grammar from this part of the papyri, none of those simple theories work. And then we have to start to look for alternate explanations and what may or may not be happening. And I think we need to do so with a little bit of humility. I think there's a lot of hubris that goes into Book of Abraham studies where we feel like, okay, this is what it is, and I've got it figured out, right? And then we need to be a little more humble and look at it and say, no, that's pretty complex. I'm not sure we can figure that out.
Indeed. Why do you think there is that hubris there? Is it because we actually have Egyptian papyri fragments as opposed to the Book of Moses or the Book of Abraham, where you know the brass or the gold plates don't, you know, aren't with us anymore? They were taken back up into heaven. Is it because we have actual evidence that people have latched onto this so heavily?
It is a little bit. I think it's that, and that lends itself to falling into. I think what is overall a problem with academia. So, and you both will have to tell me what you think, but it's been my experience, and I'm very much part of academia, and I work with scholars from all over the world and a lot of really, really brilliant guys, and I find that the best scholars are that small minority who are humble and can say, well, we can only know so much, we can only do so much, that the evidence can only yield so much, while the majority are really quick to make conclusions and to say that we know more than we actually can know. So I find that in biblical studies, I find it in Egyptology studies that have nothing to do with the Book of Abraham. I find it in just historical studies in general. Then, of course, I find it in the Book of Abraham studies. And I think we just need to say, you know what? Well, I'll just give you an example. I am shocked at things that as we study biblical texts, that people feel like they can divine out of the text that this person, this phrase and this verse was added at this time period, but this phrase and this verse was added in this time period, and this phrase was, and I just think, you have to have a crystal ball to be able to tell that, right? I don't care how good our scholarship is and how much we think that we know different sources, to get into that level, you have to have a crystal ball, but that's where many academics are. They feel like they can do that. I think we just do better if we have a little bit more humility. And so I think that kind of academic hubris in general carries over into Book of Abraham studies and causes problems.
Interesting. I remember, going back to this, talking about different strands and different authors of, the biblical books. I remember Nibley discussed that, and he said it was just kind of a circular, cheap, and easy method. And, I've thought about that quite a bit, and I realized that, if one was to apply different criteria to extracting, what we think are different strands, the results would be totally different.
Yeah. And I think there's no doubt there are different sources, different times of redaction, and different, variants in the various books and so on. There's no doubt, but I think that we can figure out exactly what it was and exactly how it happened. That's probably going beyond what we have the ability to do.
Yeah.
So I know Matt knows a lot more about this than I do, but so maybe he can correct me if he thinks I'm wrong, but
I It's interesting that you, I think epistemological humility is the is something that I've noticed also in the best scholars that I know. And one of the things I was thinking of as you were talking about that is the way academia is geared. It really, you know, scholars often feel almost compelled to really make a splash in the field. And you do that by, you know, presenting a whole, you know, a whole reworking of the data on about a certain text, or you try to say something very different than what's been said. And it's really interesting to go, you know, to SBL and to some of the sessions that deal with source criticism and some of the, you know, the cognate disciplines, and you'll have someone present a new reworking of the data on a text that differs markedly from the way people have seen it in the past, and then scholars who have the older views that they try to defend will stand up, and you know sometimes it can get kind of heated. Everybody's, you know, put a lot in, you know, they've staked a lot on their putting together of the data in a hypothetical way about what they think is going on, and you have these parties that if, you know, one person's view of the scholarship, if it's true, then the others, it completely undermines what they've done. And so you see how, you know, the lack of restraint in some cases, the lack of epistemological restraint, you know, sets scholars up to set the stakes a little bit too high.
Yeah, and I think it is inherent in academia just because of the way it's set up, right, where you cannot get a job or keep your job, right, never pass the various reviews and rank advancements and get tenure, if you are not publishing, and you can't publish if it's not original and new stuff. And so really, in order to be part of academia, you're almost forced to say, here's where everyone in the past was wrong, and I'm right. And
exactly.
That's good in some ways because it does keep us always digging and pushing and learning more and pushing the envelope forward. And it probably works exceptionally well in some scientific fields. But it also creates almost a need to disregard even good things of the past and come up with something crazy new. And that system then just lends itself to hubris, to having to be sure you're right no matter what and not listening to others or valuing other things. Anyway, and that's an overgeneralization, of course. That's a big overgeneralization. But it is kind of a little bit inherent to the system. And I think, as we've already said, that the best academics are able to say, okay, let's be careful here. Let's look at what we really can and can't do. And I would say some of the very best are the ones who are willing to say, let's look at what I said about this 5 years ago. Oh, wow, I was so wrong. I don't know why I was thinking that when I wrote that 5 years ago. So anyway.
Interesting. Just extending this topic, just really one more question, and then we'll get back to the books. Do you both feel that the community of LDS scholars suffers from the same symptoms as, you know, larger academia?
That's a loaded question.
since you're both scholars.
I hope and feel like, the gospel can ground us a little bit better and can, I hope, lead us to more humility. At the same time, we're all people. We have the natural fallen man in us as much as our divine nature as anyone. And And so I think we have the same struggles. It's inherent in the same system, but hopefully, for the most part, we do better. I may be too ensconced in it to actually objectively be able to tell, but my interactions with most of my LDS peers makes me feel like we're doing a bit better. But again, I it's difficult for me to tell. I'm right in the middle of it.
That's fair. That's fair. Matt, what do you think?
I think we do better overall. I think that, you know, where I noticed at least more recently an area of concern is there have been some Latter-day Saint scholars who've been a little too willing, I think, to air personal grievances publicly, and
absolutely
to throw other scholars, you know, other Latter-day Saint scholars under the bus, and to assume the worst in their intentions. And, you know, you see that in academia generally, where you can see some of those types of really personal issues erupt. But I think we do better, but I have been concerned to see lately, you know, a few scholars who've really, you know, attacked people personally, and you know, that's been unfortunate to see.
Yeah, I agree. There shouldn't be any place for that. That's not scholarship. That's just slander. You know, we should stick with the issues, stick with the texts. So, okay. Thank you.
I've noticed, you know, Carrie has been someone who's been on the receiving end of a number of personal attacks from other scholars. And I think he, just personally from what I've noticed, Carrie has been so gracious in the way that he's handled those kinds of things. He's shown a lot of grace and humility. That's something I admire a great deal.
Well, I hope so. Thank you for that. Thanks. I hope so. Maybe I just am too obtuse. I don't know anyone saying anything about me. I don't know. But anyway, thank you.
That's awesome. Matt, we've got a little bit more time. I want to talk in a little bit about recommendations that you all might have for our listeners who are going to be reading and studying the Old Testament, you know, this upcoming year for the Come Follow Me schedule. But Matt, you've got a book out, or coming out too, that you wrote with, is it Aaron? Is Shada, am I pronouncing that right?
Shade,
okay.
Yeah. Aaron, okay. Shade and I have a book that will be helpful for the book of, you know, the chapters in Genesis that are also, you know, broadly covered within the book of Moses. And the book is entitled The Book of Moses, from the Ancient of Days to the Latter Days. Playing on the Ancient of Days as a reference to Adam.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, we think we've, you know, done some things with that book that other people who've treated the Book of Moses in the past haven't done. It does a few new things, we think.
Cool. Can't wait.
And we think it'll be interesting and helpful to Latter-day Saint study of those chapters.
When does this book come out? I'm really, really interested in this.
Oh, sorry, what was that?
When does this book come out?
It should be out in December is what they're telling us, but with COVID there's been such a backlog with the publishers and, you know, getting books to the press. We're still waiting for the final word, but December 13th was the day that we were given, and they haven't told us anything other than that since.
Sounds like I need a bigger stocking at my fireplace.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there you go. Get a big stocking. Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm excited. I'm teaching a graduate course, our first graduate course in the Fertile Grape Price in January, and I've been trying to figure out exactly what text I wanted to use to cover Moses, so I'll have to look at this. This sounds, both you and Aaron are such great scholars and know this material so well. I really look forward to seeing what you have to say in there.
Thank you.
Now, I've got I picked up the Interpreter Foundation, had a two-day seminar over 2 different months on
right.
The Book of Moses. And I picked up both volumes, and I put them on my shelf, and my shelf collapsed.
But yeah, they are big.
To rebuild that. But they look really good. Matt, how's your book different than something like that?
Well, this book, the conference proceedings that came from the Interpreter Foundation conference, those are, papers on a variety of topics from, a number of very good Latter-day Saint scholars.
Mm-hmm.
What we've done is we've taken the text chapter by chapter, and we have some things to say about that, but we also get into the issues leading into the Joseph Smith translation. We also talk a lot about how, as this text is revealed to the prophet Joseph Smith, what impact it's having on the saints who are getting these revelations through the prophet Joseph Smith, and how it's affecting things on the ground. It's when you look at the impact of the text in the Book of Moses and the Joseph Smith translation, it's affecting in real time what the Latter-day Saints are doing in terms of attempting to build a temple and build Zion. And the temple endowment, as many Latter-day Saint scholars have rightly noted, is very much bound up with the story of Adam and Eve as we have it in the Book of Moses.
That's true, yeah.
So it's affecting things not only in terms of what the saints are doing practically in terms of attempting to build the temple in Zion, but it's affecting and influencing things in terms of the temple architecture and even the temple ritual.
I like that. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, who's publishing this book?
The Religious Studies Center and Deseret Book.
Fantastic.
So I think I'm trying to remember what the final page count was, but it's a substantially sized volume. So I mean, it's not going to break the shelf like the the two that Mark's talking about,
Tracing HD Threads conference, yeah.
Yeah, we think it'll be worth everyone's while to pick it up.
Fantastic. Yeah, I just looked and I can see it on Deseret Books website, so.
Cool. I'm planning on picking that one up myself. Sweet. This is fun. I'm a book geek just as much as I am a gospel nerd, so it is fun to chat books.
The day I don't get a book for Christmas will be a sad Christmas. Yeah. That's how I feel. So, yeah.
I know. That's kind of been my story for a whole lot of years. But that's fun. I love it. I love collecting books. Let's go ahead and broaden the topic then. What would you all recommend for our readers who are beginning the Come Follow Me program? I've seen a lot of books in the stores. One of them is this one. It's called The Essential Old Testament Companion.
Oh, that's trouble.
I was just going to say that, Terry's book.
Yeah, so I can tell you a little bit about those and how they'll be useful, and also how I'm actually a little bit happy about some ways they won't be useful. So I have the Essential Old Testament Companion, which is one I did that has like a two-page spread for each chapter that we used to cover in Gospel Doctrine, and it's got, you know, timelines and pictures and maps and major themes and just some insights like that. And then I have another one that's, I don't even remember what it's called, Scripture Study Made Simple. And that's a verse-by-verse commentary on all the chapters that we used to cover in the Old Testament. And so I think those are really helpful, and I would recommend them for Come Follow Me year. I'll tell you the way that they wouldn't be helpful. So we actually were going to redo the Essential Companion and re-release it for this year with whatever changes we needed to for Come Follow Me. And Come Follow Me came out in like July or August or something like that is when we figured out what the new Come Follow Me was. But there are enough new chapters, the chapters that we didn't cover in Gospel Doctrine that we are covering in Come Follow Me, that we didn't re-release it. We probably will do that for next time because we just didn't have time to get it done in time to get that many new things done. So I think it's still super helpful for about 80% of what we'll cover in Come Follow Me. So if you're looking for something that will help you with that, I don't know anything else that would help you with more than 80%. But I have to tell you that there's a part of me that is thrilled that we've spent so many years just reading the same chapters over and over again, and they are fantastic and important chapters. But to have some new stuff, to see that the saints are going to read some Old Testament things that maybe they haven't read before for a long time also really excites me. So I think they'd be helpful in some ways, but wow, we're gonna have new stuff to talk about this year. I think that's fantastic stuff.
Yeah, that will be fun. I'm an old Gospel Doctrine teacher, and well, maybe not that old. That's debatable. We can talk about that later. But I do remember with the old system, you know, and it would, you know, every 4 years the Old Testament would roll around again, and I remember teaching and thinking, oh, I taught this lesson 8 years ago.
Yeah,
you know, here. Here it is again. You know,
yep. We're kind of afraid of the Old Testament within the church. You notice that the Institute manuals that we have for the Old and New Testament in, they haven't changed in, I don't know, 40 years at least. And, yeah. You know, we're kind of intimidated by it, and we shouldn't be. I think we have some real opportunity here to seize the day with it.
I think the way that members of the church are doing Come Follow Me, I mean, they're avidly doing it. It's fantastic. I think we're going to find that we have people understanding the Old Testament in a way they haven't before because they're going to get into it. Come Follow Me has good material in it, and then we have all of these other helpful things to read. There's another one that's coming out that I think is really useful also from the Religious Studies Center. It's called From Creation to Sinai. Dan Belknap and Aaron Shade, so Matt's co-author on the other book, they edited this one, but basically what they did is they asked different scholars to handle different topics. So I should say you'll love its subtitle. Its subtitle is The Old Testament Through the Lens of the Restoration. And they asked different authors to take a topic, so someone who does Genesis 1 through 3 and someone who does Moses 5 and someone who does Enoch and crazy people to do Israel, Egypt, and Canaan, or the Exodus, and things like that. But to write about it from a very academically informed position, but with a Latter-day Saint lens to help explain this to the lay Latter-day Saint. And I think that they've produced something. It only covers up, you know, from Genesis up through Exodus, the Exodus story. And it's fantastic.
I got the law codes section, but they asked me to do look at the law codes for that book. And so we go at least
chapter 16
up through that.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be really useful. I mean, this book's actually about 6 years in the making, but I think it's going to be a useful one. And then the Religious Studies Center has another one that they're coming out with that I'm trying to remember what it's called. I'll find it here. I just had it. It's called, sorry, I can't find it now. Anyway, it's something about holiness or something like that. But it's where they've gone through all the Religious Study Center's old publications and taking out the ones that the different articles that they thought were best for various topics, and then just given that made that a chapter in this book so that you can. It's kind of a best of Religious Study Center publications on the Old Testament, and it will be really helpful. I'll find the name for you here in just a second.
That sounds pretty good. It sounds like what they did with the Sperry Symposiums a few years ago.
Yeah, and they did a similar version of this for this Come Follow Me year on the Restoration. They did a similar version for of that. So, and I know this book's name so well, and I'm having a hard time, but I'll find it here as we go along, and I'll just blurt it out when I find it. So
that sounds good. Matt, what would you recommend then?
I thought another one that would be good. I'm not even sure it's still in print, but Jehovah and the World of the Old Testament,
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
By Richard Nigel Holtzopfel, Dana Pike, and David Healy. That it's filled with great informational bits throughout, and great visuals.
Yeah,
to help people
really good visuals
really picture what's going on, and help them to appreciate the material culture that we encounter in the Old Testament, and really helps orient them with to the geography,
mm-hmm.
and lots of archaeology. Yeah, I mean it's excellent cover to cover.
Very good. Do you guys have any recommendations of scholarly books by non-Latter-day Saint scholars that you would recommend?
So, first of all, I'll say the book whose name I couldn't remember is called Approaching Holiness.
Okay.
Good question by non-Latter-day Saint scholars.
I think I would go to people like maybe Robert Alter. Look at the Art of Biblical
Narrative. I was just going to say his three-volume he put together.
The big translation?
The translation is, you know, pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But maybe even more helpful for the audience is the footnotes.
Yeah,
I don't necessarily agree with every position he takes, but he is a careful reader and, you know, and insightful in his reading. And, you know, there's a lot to be gained from his work. I endorse it.
Yeah, he's a fun scholar. I love reading his stuff. I think I enjoy his methods and his results because it shows how the text, you know, should feel rather than necessarily how it should be read. It's more of a feeling and a response that, you know, you get from his translations than, you know, it is necessarily a literal, you know, translation. You know, you kind of get the mood of what the scripture's saying.
Yeah, and that's a strength he has, since he's a literature guy first and then a Hebrew guy. He has a knack for feeling how to present literature. So,
yeah, so
that's a
maybe
good one.
Why I've enjoyed his work so much, because I was a literature guy as an undergraduate in school, and then as an English major, and then kind of came at antiquity, you know, from that. It sort of entered it from that world.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I came about the same way. Yeah, I started out the same path, you know, literature and English, and then it just kind of kept going back in time.
If someone wants a just a kind of a study Bible to read alongside the King James Version, I encourage students to read in multiple. You know, I have a lot of international students, and I encourage them to read in multiple languages, but also multiple versions.
Yeah,
and a good one is the and, you know, not perfect, but good, is the New Revised Standard Version that HarperCollins puts out, the HarperCollins Study Bible, that has the Apocrypha and the Deuterocanonical books.
Mm-hmm.
It's worthwhile. I mean, the NRSV is probably the, I don't know, all the translations have their pros and their cons, but the NRSV, you know, seems to be pretty pretty solid, and so that's one I will point students to quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. I also like the Jewish Publication Society translation,
yeah.
But I'll tell you about a tool that I think is fantastic. It's called netbible.org. So netbible.org. And they have, you can go on there and they have their own translation. You can go to the Old Testament or the New Testament, and they have their own translation. But they also have a feature where you can look at side by side about seven translations of each verse.
Yes.
So you can see all these translations, one right after the other. And then if you want to, you can click or highlight a verse, and over on the other side, it will show you the Hebrew word, and the Hebrew definition will come up for it. Or when you get to the New Testament, same thing with Greek. And they have some commentaries that you can click on for that as well. And so it's a free online resource that has all sorts of great things.
That sounds terrific.
So I was just going to say, in addition, Kerry, to what you were saying, you know, the NRSV, the HarperCollins one, has good footnotes. But you mentioned the JPS.
Looks like we're getting played off here. So we will return to you guys very shortly. And
really
this has been the Interpreter Radio Show.
You are listening to K-Talk Media, KBJA, AM 1640, Sandy, Salt Lake, and the entire Wasatch Front. Live.
Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
This is The Interpreter Show on Interpreter Radio. The Interpreter Show is a production of The Interpreter Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization, a 501c3 organization, which is dedicated to the defense and explanations of the scriptures of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And it's a doctrine. It puts on symposium. It puts a weekly journal out with a new article, new scholarly article every week, which is absolutely free for you to read online at interpreterfoundation.org. And I'm happy to have you here. My name is Mark Johnson. I'm the host today. I'm joined by Matthew Bowen. Hey, Matt.
I'm still here.
Oh, I'm
Aloha,
glad
Mark.
Of that. Aloha, Matt. And then Kerry Milstein, are you still here, Kerry, with us?
I am.
Oh,
I am.
This is a treat.
Aloha also.
This is fun. And then we say aloha because Professor Bowen is at the University, or BYU Hawaii, right, for his work. And
Kerry used to teach here.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. You guys are just world travelers. I'm jealous.
And we were talking about Aaron Shade in the earlier hour. He also used to teach there.
Oh, that's right. I remember reading that.
Yes, indeed.
That is pretty cool. All right, so we are going to transition into our Come Follow Me lesson. I need to mention also our other sponsor, that is LDSAgents.com, which is a network of over 2,000 real estate agents that are Latter-day Saints, and they want to help you buy and sell your home. And it's crazy out there, and you need some help. And who better to call than LDSAgents.com? You can look them up on the internet, go check out their helpful site, and, you know, send them a message. Let them know what you're looking for. If you're looking for a big house, if you're upscaling or downsizing, just, you know, give them a call, and they'll be able to help you out. We had been talking with Matt and Kerry about books. I've got one more question that I forgot to ask Kerry before we get into our Come Follow Me section. I was talking to a friend of mine, Robbie Robbins, And he said that he spent some time with Carrie at the BYU Jerusalem Center way back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
And he,
back when we were students, yeah.
And he had a question he wanted to ask you about your books. And I quote, "How do you have so much time to do all these books?"
Well, I don't know that I have so much time. I mean, I am blessed to have a job where they want me to research, and so they give me some time for that. But it also ends up being a whole lot of early mornings and you know, 20 minutes here and 20 minutes there. You just I've learned if I want to write a book, I have to say first thing in the morning, I'm going to ignore all my emails and all my phone calls and everything else and just write for half an hour or something like that, and not let anything interrupt me. And on a good day, then I have a hard time stopping that, and it'll go longer than that. But I don't have that much time, really, where you just got to fiddle in and be efficient.
And from what I know about Matt, I think the same question would apply. I know you're plenty busy too.
Yeah, it's what Carrie. I relate a lot to what Carrie just said. You have to. It comes in those 20-minute spurts sometimes, where you know it's, and you have to be strategic. That's all I can say.
That's a good word. I like that, strategic. So anyway, Carrie, Robbie says hi.
Tell him hi for me.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so we've got our second hour of the Interpreter Show is dedicated to the upcoming, or one of the upcoming, Come Follow Me lessons. And, you know, we've switched over to the Old Testament now, which is going to be a lot of fun. I'm really excited about this. So this show talks about the second lesson, which is the creation. So in the creation, we've got a number of texts, you know, which deal with this topic. We've got chapters out of Genesis. We've got chapters out of the book of Moses. We've got chapters out of the book of Abraham. And we're going to be looking at all of those. Matt, you want to give us a quick overview of at least the Genesis portions and maybe the book of Moses portions?
Yeah, we have the creation, you know, we've got a creation account in Genesis chapter 1 that breaks down into 6 days and takes us from the, you know, that phrase, which is, has been debated long and has had a lot of ink spilled over it, that phrase, Bereshit bara, you know, Bereshit bara Elohim, in the beginning God created, or depending on what translation you read, when God set about to create the heaven and the earth, or the heavens and the earth, and then, you know, taking us all the way up to the beginning of Genesis chapter 2 with that seventh period that then corresponds to the Sabbath day. I think for me, one of the most enlightening things I've discovered in recent years, you know, it's not my discovery, but, you know, that it, as I've probed into this, are the connections here that ancient Israelites would have made between the creation account and the tabernacle. In chapter, you know, beginning about chapter 25 of Exodus, and the chapters thereafter, you know, that describes the setting up of the tabernacle and the, you know, a lot of things that, you know, pertain ritually to what was done in the tabernacle. It's been fruitful for me to see how the creation account is being told, especially in chapter 1, in a way that, and but also in chapter 2, in a way that brings us into the temple and the purposes of the temple. that, you know, helps to see creation as, you know, like the setting up of the tabernacle in Exodus, that the creation is kind of, you know, the establishment of God's created order mirrors something of a temple.
That's an interesting idea. I know a lot of scholars have written on that, especially mentioning how on the seventh day God rested. And they point to the word rest and say that resting is something that a god does in a temple in the ancient Near East.
Yeah. In fact, that word Shabbat, you know, that verb, and I point out to Latter-day Saint students, this is a Hebrew word, you know, Shabbat, and the as a noun, and the related verb Shabbat, it means to not just to cease or to stop doing something, and it gets translated by English translators going back to near the beginning as rest. Mm-hmm. But it really means to come to the end of an activity, so that then you transition to a state of rest or nuach.
Interesting. I like that. What else is important for us to know about these chapters, Matt?
I think that when you read it in Hebrew, and this is one as a Hebrew student, that if you've taken Hebrew courses, you tend to read this text a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That it just when you read it out loud in Hebrew, it's just very pleasurable to say the words, and I think they would have. That they got a lot of enjoyment not only out of reading the text, but hearing it read.
Yeah, that makes sense. I remember back to a few of the Hebrew classes I've had, you know, and we definitely went over the first chapter of Genesis a few times. It was fun to read, almost as fun as the Tower of Babel story.
There's repetition,
mm-hmm.
but there's repetition with variation, as Gary Rensberg points out in some of the work that he's done. And it's that combination of repetition and variation. So you see the creation being described in very orderly process type terms, but then there is variation in the telling and the description of it, and it's really enjoyable.
I like that. That's a fun way to look at it. Carrie, why don't you give us a little intro to the Book of Abraham material that talks about the same period here, and, you know, maybe give us your thoughts or maybe some contrasts to, you know, what Matt's been talking about, or just your insights about this material.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So the Book of Abraham material is very, very similar to the Genesis material. It's actually in most ways more similar than the Book of Moses material, even though that's the Joseph Smith translation of Genesis. But we get a whole lot of new verses in there, and some of them really key, some really new stuff in the Moses material. But the Book of Abraham material is really the oldest. Right, so the Genesis material and the Book of Moses material date from at the earliest Moses, and then, you know, I would guess that the Genesis material has been through some redactors and gets changed or something, I don't know, edited in some way or another, but it can't be edited too much because the Book of Abraham, that's written by Abraham, who predates Moses by a ways.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it may also have had, I can't imagine that the Book of Abraham didn't also have some redactors or editors that went through it, and maybe they tried to sync the different accounts they were familiar with and make them look similar or something along those lines. I don't know, but it is, it's the oldest, at least in its original base form, right? And I think that that's worth stopping for just a moment to talk about and recognize that As Latter-day Saints, our theology very much can accommodate the idea that we don't really have the original of any of these books of Scripture. We have later versions of them that have been edited, and that actually includes the Doctrine and Covenants and even the Book of Mormon, right? The Joseph Smith, the editions that were printed in his life, he was always kind of editing it just a little bit and making a change here or there. And same thing with the Doctrine and Covenants and the revelations that he gave us there. You're always going through this editorial process. So as Latter-day Saints, we understand that Joseph Smith told us it was happening with the Bible. And we can assume that it happened with the Book of Abraham as well, or else it's unique. If it didn't happen, it's the only book of Scripture it didn't happen with. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's something important to recognize as we get into creation and just Old Testament in general. There are a couple of things that are worth recognizing. One, we don't have the text that Moses wrote the way he wrote it himself. We don't have the text that Abraham wrote the way he wrote it himself. We have texts that have gone through editorial glosses, and they very well may be inspired editors, just like Mormon and Moroni were inspired editors that give us, you know, we only get Alma through Mormon, right, and so on. So there are inspired editors, but it also highlights another important point, which is this, that actually none of our Scripture, even, remember, Joseph Smith calls the Book of Mormon the most correct book. He doesn't say completely, fully, 100% correct with no flaw in it.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, its authors tell us that there are flaws in it. The problem is that they're trying to convey perfect gospel principles with an imperfect mind using an imperfect language, and then we try and pick that up with our own imperfect mind and our own imperfect understanding of language, and it's just not going to be able to convey those perfect gospel principles unless we have the Spirit with us.
That's true.
So that's really the key.
Yeah, and in the case of the Bible, we've had, you know, numerous translations built upon translations. So we've got, you know, that that filter as well. We've got to you know, get the Scriptures through.
And so we know that the Scriptures, in the way that they are written or printed in a book, have some flaws in them. We're very aware of that. But if you have the Spirit with you when you read them, then we overcome those flaws, right? That's the key. The way Elder Oaks once put it when he was Elder Oaks, not President Oaks, is he said that the Scriptures were not our ultimate source. They were what he called the penultimate source, which means like second to last. That the ultimate source is the revelation that, or the Spirit that is with you as you read them. They open you up to the Spirit to teach you the truths that they were trying to convey, to teach them to you in perfect truth. So as we go through the Old Testament, I think it's important just to keep that in mind.
I was just going to say, that's what the whole restoration's about right there, what Kerry is saying. That's really, in essence, a big part of what the restoration, where it puts us.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and that's just key to understanding any Scripture, but I think especially the Old Testament. Now, if we're going to summarize the Book of Abraham creation story in general, first of all, let's also say we need to know something of the story of the translation or the publication of the Book of Abraham. So in my book, Let's Talk About the Book of Abraham, I go through this history in more detail than we'll go here. But we need to understand that when Joseph Smith published it, he wasn't done publishing it. And he wasn't done translating it. He may have translated more than what we currently have, and he may not. There's some debate about that, and I don't think we can tell academically. I don't think we can tell, but there's no doubt he intended to publish more. He said it. John Taylor said it in the Times and Seasons, the same newspaper he was published in, that more was going to be published. He just didn't get around to publishing it. So, in fact, Chapter 5 just ends still in the middle of the creation story. It feels like it ends in the middle, and that's because it does. We don't have the whole thing. So we also need to know that there's a little bit of an abrupt ending here. But if we're going to look at some differences, I think there are two really key differences between the Abraham creation account and the Genesis. As I said, they're mostly the same. You do get some Hebrew words thrown into the Abraham account that is probably the result of Joseph Smith having studied Hebrew and recognizing these words and inserting them in there. But those aren't the big differences. The two big differences are the agent, the actor. So in Genesis, you have, you know, third person, God. All right. In fact, let's compare Genesis, Moses, and Abraham for a second. In Genesis, you have third person singular. He, God, created, right? In Moses, for the first quite a while, you have first person singular. I, God. And the interesting thing is that you get the switch to he, God, when you get the fall. And so I think literarily, it's a tool. And suddenly, we're no longer hearing from God himself because we're cut off from the fall and we're going to interact with God through intermediaries. So suddenly, it's he, God. I think that's a really interesting literary element of the book of Moses. So you've got third person singular in Genesis, first person singular in the book of Moses, and you have first person plural. Third person plural. So I'll get my grammar right. You've got third person plural in the book of Abraham, where it says to begin with it's first person, and then it goes to third. So it starts out with, then the Lord said, let us go down. And then it switches to third person. And they went down at the beginning, and they, that is the gods, organized and formed the heavens and the earth. And you keep getting this, they, the gods, and the gods called the light day, and the darkness they called night. And so there's a plurality here. And it's interesting because this follows right on the heels of an Abraham chapter 3, where Abraham has shown that there are many noble and great ones, and that God said to Abraham he was among those noble and great ones, and then there was one among them like unto God, and this would be Christ, who says to the others, we will go down and we will prove them, we will organize, and so on. And so you have this plural group planning the creation in Abraham chapter 3, and it's clear that the group is God overseeing it, but led by Christ with other noble, free mortal spirits who are with him. And that must be the group that's being referred to in chapter 4, because in chapter 3, that's who's planning the creation. In chapter 4, we see the creation happening. So you've got this plural group bringing about the creation. And then you have what to me is one of the most intriguing phrases in anything about the creation ever. And that is that several times in the book of Abraham creation account, you have them watching until they were obeyed. So, for example, in verse 10, chapter 4, verse 10, and the gods pronounced the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters pronounced they great waters. And the gods saw that they were obeyed. Or in other places it says they watched until they're obeyed. And so you have this. Different people debate about what the meaning of that is. Is it that everything has its agency, right? So even like we talk about, even the dust obeys God, well, it has agency or not? Or is it that they set a process in motion and they watched until the process finished? And there are different ways people interpret that phrase. But I find it really interesting that it talks about these elements obeying them, and sometimes they're waiting to see that they are obeyed.
And it's interesting that those moments where it says they watched or watched until they were obeyed, they correspond in places in Genesis to where we see God saw that they were good. And it's very kind of brief or laconic, and here it's, you know, it gives us a lot of insight into what that concept of good would mean in terms of, you know, how the creation unfolded.
Right. Yeah, that you're right. That is the kind of semi-corresponding or semi-equivalent phrase in the Genesis or Moses accounts.
Very interesting. I like
and
that.
Well, go ahead, Mike. There's another couple interesting things here, too. I know Carrie's noted this, that instead of the word create in the Genesis account,
yeah,
in the book of Abraham, you get that word organize.
Yes.
And not only that, but then you've got this word counsel. You know, that the gods took counsel together and that they made decisions. And that really, you know, as Elder Ballard has really sort of got us thinking as Latter-day Saints a lot more about the principles of counseling, taking counsel together. It helps us see how not only the family and church organization here on earth mirrors the family organization in heaven, and the divine process of counseling and making decisions and how those are really divine processes.
Yeah, on earth as it is in heaven, our counsels mirror at least something that is going on in the premortal and currently still, as we could call it, supramortal, or but the heavenly realms, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we can. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I had a quick question for Carrie. You mentioned how this cuts off so abruptly in Abraham 5.
Yes.
I know John Gee has talked about. He thinks that there's about, we have about, I think, 25%, he estimates, of what Joseph Smith originally translated of the Book of Abraham. Where do you come down on that?
So I think it's very possible. I'll tell you, and I go through this a little bit in my book, Let's Talk About the Book of Abraham, but I'll tell you the source for that. At least this, I think this is where John is getting it from, and he and I have talked about it. Maybe I'm forgetting some other data he has on this, but I think it's coming from this source. There's a really interesting account by Anson Call. And so we have to put on our historian's hat to be able to assess this account, right? So, and the account, just even in the way it's recorded, is a little bit problematic. Because Anson Call has a journal that he writes, and it's after, these most of it's written after the fact, although he seems to be relying on some earlier records that he's written, but it's hard to tell. And he has a son that's helping him write these. And in most of the versions of that journal, the paragraph that we're going to talk about isn't there. And I had to go up to the church archives to puzzle this through, because I kept seeing versions of this where it's not there, and then suddenly you get versions where it is, and it seems like he must have gone back at some point. And this is a journal that he had kind of worked on for his publishing for his descendants. So it's the publications of this. Most of them don't have it, but at some point he must have added a couple of things. Someone should go through and compare and see if he added other things. But I'm not an Anson Call expert, so I'm not going to go through all of his journals and compare to see what differences there are. But in some versions he has added, but it was he apparently, with the help of his son, that added this paragraph. And in this paragraph, he says that when he is in Far West, so this is 1838, he's in Far West, and he goes to the store in Far West, and the two boxes arrive. And the storekeeper says, Brother Joseph will be much pleased with these. Would you help me, Brother Call, carry these over to him? And so they do, and Joseph is in a meeting. But they come in, and Joseph is excited, and they open these boxes that have just arrived. And in one of them is what he calls the new translation of the Bible. We call it the Joseph Smith translation. So he's been waiting for those documents that he's created to be shipped in. And the other is the translation of the Book of Abraham. Now, just that in and of itself makes you think there must be a bit. I don't know why it would need a whole box when it would be about four pages. So if it were just what we had, right? So maybe a little bit more than four, but not a lot. So then Anson records in his journal that Joseph said, Brother Call, sit down. You will enjoy this. Sit down and listen to us. And then he says, that they read out loud from the Book of Abraham, Oliver Cowdery reading until his voice gave out, and then another brother read, altogether taking about 2 hours. Now, you can sit down and read at a very slow pace the current text of the Book of Abraham and read it in about half an hour. So that's, I think, where Dr. Gee is getting this 25%, because that would mean then that we have about 25%. But the account's a little problematic, not only that it's later reminiscent that he's adding it in, but also that he said the first person to read until his voice gave out was Oliver Cowdery. And Oliver Cowdery, at this point, is excommunicated and not with Joseph Smith and not in Far West. So it couldn't have been Oliver Cowdery that read, so he's at least misremembering that. So that gives us a question as to what to do with this account. All right, so as a historian, I have to say, okay, I'm not going to take it fully 100% at its word, but at the same time, I suspect, and he's remembered this later, so he may, he's going to remember some things wrong, and he obviously has remembered something wrong. But At the same time, I doubt he's just making this up. He has no motivation to make it up. There's nothing he's trying to prove, no reason to make it up. And so it's easy to misremember who was there. And it's also probably easy to misremember exactly how long it took. And maybe he didn't have look at his clock and then look. He said about 2 hours, right? But still, I doubt you confuse 2 hours with half an hour. That just doesn't seem like it's going to happen. And so that's pretty good evidence that he has translated more than the material that we have today. I don't know that we can say for sure. The account is problematic and so on, but I think we can say it's quite likely. I think that's a fair historical assessment of this. It is quite likely that he had already translated more than what we have today. There's some other evidence that would argue against that, and that's why I think we can't take it too, as ironclad, but it still is evidence that needs to be taken into account.
That's about where I think I fall on the topic, too. And I think I believe that at least the substance of the Anson Call Journal.
Yeah.
If some of the details are wrong. And yes, full disclosure, Anson Call is my third great grandfather. So,
well, there you go.
You know.
and my sister, her last name is now Call, and she's also now married into that family. So. We have great respect for Anson Call. I really do. It's certainly worth respecting.
Yeah.
So I'm not trying to diss what he's saying.
Not at all. I understand the arguments, and I think there's also other instances that the prophet has taught things that he says were from the Book of Abraham or from Abraham's time that aren't in. Either the Genesis or the Joseph Smith translation or the Book of Abraham. And it seems to me, and I wrote about this in my 2017 paper on the Book of Abraham, that, a likely source would be from this unpublished portion of the manuscripts.
Yeah. Yep.
There's a handful of things out there that the prophet has taught. A little bit about, I'm trying to pull it up on my phone, but my phone's being problematic. But I guess we don't need to go into that.
He does say a few times, like he teaches a couple of things. He says, as are written on the papyrus that, as was written by Abraham and is on the papyrus in my office. Mm-hmm. You're like, hey, wait, that's not in the Book of Abraham. So at the very least, he knows more of what's on the papyri. And again, that suggests that he's translated more. But,
it's not evidence. So I think...
Yeah.
I think I would say that there's certainly room in the discussion for there to be more. But it's not conclusive, positively or negatively.
Yeah.
On that point. So. All
right. Yeah, I think that's fair.
Matt, does that get your question?
I appreciated that. Yeah, I knew that John wasn't just pulling that out of the air. I know that he had he'd done the math. I was just trying to, wondered where Kerry came down with respect to what, the calculations that he'd run on that.
Yeah. I'll tell you, John Geet never pulls anything out of the air.
No, he does not. When we were talking about epistemology, he's the one that really helped me to understand, the importance of, what do you know and how do you know it?
Yeah. Yep, and know your data well, but know what it can and can't do. Yeah.
Know the limitations.
Mm-hmm. I think that we're lucky in the church to have him. He's such a careful scholar.
Yeah.
Let's see. What else do we need to know then about the creation accounts? Are they literal? Is it myth? where do you guys fall on that?
Well, I'll tell you, I end up teaching creation accounts a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because I teach Old Testament and I teach Pearl of Great Price, and both of them have creation accounts. And so that question you just asked is something that I'm asked all the time. And I've been teaching Old Testament since 1994, right? I mean, this a number of years now.
Mm-hmm.
And I get asked that all the time about things, the creation account in general, all sorts of things in the creation accounts, things to do with the fall, and a host of other questions. And this is really kind of my standard answer. There are lots of things that I can't tell if they are literal or not. Now, I think that, I mean, God could, well, we'll come back to that in a moment, all right? There's certainly a literal element, but we'll come back to that in a moment. But there are lots of things I can't tell if they're literal or not. But they are always symbolic. Always symbolic. Even when they're literal, they're symbolic. And I think the more important thing is to figure out what is the symbolism. What does God want us to learn through the symbolism? So now let's go back to that, talking about whether they're literal. I mean, there's an element of this that has to be literal. The question is, what is God trying to do here? God could, I would guess, through his prophets, give us any number of kinds of creation accounts. He could give us, a geophysical creation account. He could give us a subatomic creation account. He could give us the astronomical creation account. And it's interesting to me that, for example, when Moses asks him, in Moses chapter 1, Moses asks him, tell me basically why and how, but he says, by what, why and by what you made these things. Mm-hmm. And with all of the different kinds of explanations God could give him as to how he creates it, he says, by the word of my power or by my only begotten son, right? His answer is, well, by Christ I created these. So that's telling us, this of all the things God could tell us, that's what he wants us to know about the how. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't explore the other stuff. We should, explore everything with every kind of avenue of learning we have. But keep in mind that for God, that's the most important element for us to learn. So, again, as we look at this creation account, and we have to be mindful that none of the creation accounts are identical, including if we're going to include the temple creation account. It's not identical with these. Three of the four of them we get from Joseph Smith, and yet those three are all different from each other, sometimes in order, sometimes in all sorts of other things, right, in the order of what's created when. And so it's clear that God is trying to give us an account that will teach us some things that he wants us to learn. So there, I think, is the point we need to begin at. I don't know how much of this is literal. There's certainly some potent symbolism that we can talk about in a moment if you want, but what we need to keep in mind is God wants us to learn something. He's presented this in this way so that we will learn something. What should we learn? And there are tons of answers to that. It's not just this is what he wants us to learn. It's just this one thing. Lots of different answers to that, but I would approach it that way rather than trying to figure out, okay, what kind of a model is this? I'd just say, what does God want me to learn from this?
Yeah, that's a really good way to look at it. I think that I personally lean that, I challenge my own assumptions on this and, challenge the assumptions behind the question and say, why does it have to be one or the other? Why can't it be both at the same time?
Right.
But
there's certainly a literal aspect to this.
Really,
I
really endorse what Kerry is saying about this, that we need to, when we talk about how the Lord teaches us, what's the Lord's way of teaching,
mm-hmm.
It is through symbolism.
Yeah.
And that we have to see, everything on one level is, at least one level, is being symbolic. When God revealed, when he gave Abraham his revelation, when he gave Moses his revelation, when we have the ancient Israelite custodians of this material, they weren't evolutionary biologists. They weren't astrophysicists. God was speaking to them according to their own understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And, you get President Kimball, I'll just give you one example here, talking about how he said that the story of the rib in Genesis 21 and 22 is symbolic. But when he said it wasn't literal, it's symbolic. But when you start to unpack the symbolism of the rib and, the connection of the rib to life and life-giving from Samaria to ancient Israel and the concept of the how all of this relates to the temple, David Calibro has made a really interesting connection, I think, with the rib.
I'm glad you brought this up. Yeah, go ahead.
In connection with the side chambers of the temple. And, Carrie, be familiar with this one. I was really struck when reading the Egyptian story of the story of the shipwrecked sailor. You have that temple there whose, two sides are in the water, and, one of the, the guest pair, and the idea of the rib there. That there's a connection between, ribs and bodies and vital organs and the temple.
And the
woman isn't created from the rib, she's built from the rib. And there's just, it's very, there are some really fruitful things, I think, that we can understand from just the dense, tightly packed symbolism that's in this account.
Kimball also drew on, and I don't know if he knew he was drawn on, that some ancient rabbis had said this as well, but also that the rib connoted that they were side by side, not one above the other, and so on. So, I mean, you see that how there are different layers and levels of symbolism there.
Yes. And so, if we're looking at this to be a cosmology from the perspective of an astrophysicist, we're asking the text to do something that it was never intended to do. But then, but if we allow the Lord to speak to us as we do in the temple through the symbolism that's there, and to teach us the principles of the gospel, then we're really open, I think, to getting the instruction that He would give us.
So maybe I could just walk us through a little bit of at least one little bit of set of symbols that I think, Matt talked about God talking according to their understanding and the way they would get things.
Yes.
I think we can just see a couple of symbols that will help us understand some of how that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So in the ancient Near East, whether it be Egypt or Mesopotamia or really anywhere throughout the ancient Near East, the idea of creation is not that it's ex nihilo, it's out of nothing. It's that there was material already there that needed to be organized.
Mm-hmm.
And typically that material is symbolized by water. They would call it chaos, or that's how they, we translate what they would call it in Egyptian. There are lots of different things you can call it, but it's chaos, meaning unorganized stuff. And water is the symbol of that, and that makes sense, right? Water, we're not talking on the subatomic level, just on the way they would deal with water. Water can take whatever shape. It doesn't have a form of its own. It takes whatever shape of whatever you put it in, right? It doesn't have a shape of its own. And then creation is, so, for example, the Egyptians will call the period before creation, they'll call it the before there were two things. Meaning everything is the same. It's all this big primordial soup. It's this big watery chaos. And creation is when one thing is organized in a way that it's different than all of the other stuff. And that's symbolized by dry land coming out of the water, right? And so, again, for the Egyptians, they'll see this when the Nile floods and then it starts to recede. You see dry land, that's creation beginning. But it's this idea that creation comes symbolically out of watery chaos and dry land appears. So with that in mind, then if we start to look at, say, Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, where it says, the earth was without form. There's no form, right? It's void. And darkness was upon the face of the deep. The deep what? This is deep water.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's what it is. It's water. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. Suddenly, that's the first thing. Right? Now there's something that's different than everything else. But then, of course, we're going to start to divide the water from the land and so on. And he makes a firmament, and that firmament, you're tempted to read that and think, oh, that's dry land, but it's firmament that divides the waters which are under from that which is above. And suddenly, if you were to draw that, you would end up drawing it exactly where the Egyptians and Mesopotamians do, which is where you've got a sphere with water all around it, because the sphere is the organized material, and it's watery chaos all around it. And so if you have that kind of creation in mind, you suddenly see that the language of Genesis 1 speaks to people who understand creation through that set of symbols. It's using the symbols they were familiar with to tell them that there was someone, as is said more explicitly in Abraham chapter 3, there was someone, individual, group, whichever creation account we're going to look at, who went to the unorganized, chaotic material and organized it into something that it wasn't chaotic. It was organization. It was creation, we could call it. And he just tells that story using symbols that they get, and sometimes we struggle to get.
I think that's one of the difficulties we have as modern readers, that, you know, we're not plugged into the ancient mindset. We're not familiar with the way that they understood the universe, you know, or the structure that you talked about, Carrie, about, you know, the, you know, ancient model of cosmology.
Yeah. And cosmogony, both. And we're also not as symbol-oriented as they were. In fact, I would say this is one of the big keys, if we're going to be here at the beginning of talking about the Old Testament, one of the biggest keys for understanding the Old Testament is to get symbol-oriented. We live in a world that's increasingly divorcing itself from symbols. And I think at least part of the reason why is that we're in a very legalistic world. So we want, you know, A to have, point A to have one meaning and one meaning only.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not how symbols work. And we're increasingly uncomfortable with that. We have to become very symbol-oriented. I think when it says that God speaks to man in their own language and according to their own understanding, but that's not just whether it's Portuguese or English. It's also the way you're used to communicating, and the Old Testament peoples were used to communicating through symbols. And as Matt said, that's God's preferred way to teach. And so I think we will see a lot of symbols, both symbols in the text, but symbolic actions, symbolic historical events. We just need to start thinking in terms of symbols. So, in fact, I think I'm going to... I need to write some of this stuff down to help people get this. All right. So, Matt, you and I have to write something about this sometime.
We got this. We'll do it.
All right.
I'll write
the introduction for the book.
All right.
We'll get started. We have this idea of creation versus non-creation that's very heavily influenced by Platonism and Middle Platonism, Neoplatonism, this idea of just sort of non-existence, and then the idea of creation being, you know, it coming into actual existence from non-existence. And that wasn't the ancient Israelite idea of creation at all. You know, something could physically exist, but it wasn't organized or created until it had its purpose. It had to be functional. You know, once something had its function that within the real world, now it's created or organized.
Matt, are you going back to the...
It's ready to go.
You going back to the John Walton book?
Yes.
Excellent. That's one I wanted to mention the first hour as well. But go ahead with this, though.
So it's that idea. Like Carrie's been talking about, we got to start thinking in terms of how the ancients thought about things. And, you know, life for them was very... We live in a world where we have so much more leisure time, you know, compared to what they had. You know, they had to do so much in terms of subsistence living just to get through the day. And we have so many things that, you know, give us leisure time because of the work that they remove from our lives. So, you know, we're not that far away from that, really. I mean, you know, you look back at the time of the prophet Joseph Smith and the early Latter-day Saints, you know, they were still in that, you know, things hadn't really changed all that much from, many centuries going back in terms of the work required just to get through the day. So, you know, we got to recapture some of the mentality of our ancestors and thinking in terms of the functional symbols that they were familiar with. And that's why Jesus taught in parables, right? I mean, he was speaking to them and using the symbols and language of the everyday that they were very familiar with.
And parables are just extended symbols. Parables and allegories, that's all they are.
Yeah.
So we really shouldn't be surprised then if these same kind of methods of teaching and, you know, explaining things show up in the creation accounts, for instance. Because that's
right.
that was their bread and butter. That was their everyday lives.
We should be surprised if they didn't.
Yeah. Exactly. And so we shouldn't also expect that expect our creation accounts to match up with what we view as a scientific or astronomical creation, because that's not what they were writing about.
And yet it is fun to see when, you know, Carrie mentioned that none of these ancient Near Eastern creation accounts had any concept of creatio ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. And yet the prophet Joseph Smith, when he's teaching that matter cannot be created or destroyed, he's 100% right on that from both the ancient perspective on it and from the modern, astrophysics perspective.
Yeah. Let me just add to that, you know, creation can't be destroyed matter can't be destroyed or created, but can be lost. And I call that the car keys principle.
That's my children and the car keys for sure.
Yeah. Yep. Almost didn't make it to the show today because of that very thing.
So, and this is a little bit of a segue or a tangent, but only a little bit. I'm actually really thinking we need to get a lot of these kinds of ideas out there to help people as they go to understand the Old Testament. So I'm going to kind of give, and you'll decide never to have me on the show again, but I'm going to kind of give the Interpreter Foundation a little challenge on this, that maybe you could cull through all the different articles and podcasts you have and create a little page somewhere that just is like aids for understanding the Old Testament. And I've got a really simple little website called outofthedust.org, but I'm going to do the same thing to have just aids to understanding the Old Testament, where we can link to different articles and different things people have done to say, okay, well, people need to understand symbols. Oh, like Don Perry talked about symbolic action in this publication and so on. And we can put together some things that will help people understand the Old Testament.
I like it. We're on it. Go ahead.
We've got Jack Welch over here in Hawaii, too. And I don't know if they've got Old Testament Central running, but, you know, that might be another place to get this going. This needs to be done.
Yeah, because people, I think that we, as we said earlier, people really want to understand, or they really want to do Come Follow Me, and probably the most daunting of all the years is going to be this year, and yet there's good stuff out there to help people. We just need to kind of collate it for them, so I'm all right. We're on this. We're gonna do this.
I think this will be the year. I've talked with some of the Book of Mormon Central folks that I'm going to spearhead the Book of Habakkuk Central. So,
oh, perfect.
Got to start somewhere.
That'll be a great big giant website.
Oh, tons of resources, brand new translation, all the works. I really am looking forward to seeing what we can get out of this year, though. There are so many popular podcasts and, publications coming out, video series on YouTube and other platforms. There really is an explosion of interest in, following the Come Follow Me program. And that's one of the reasons why I'm excited to be part of the Interpreter Show, is to, help people along that path, give them, point them in different directions about, finding access to new information about, topics on the Old Testament, like some of the issues that we have with creation. So it's an exciting
thing. Sounds great. That sounds fantastic.
All right, we've got a few minutes left before we're going to be played out. Any other thoughts before we...
Maybe I have one more. I know I've been talking a lot, but maybe I can give you just one more.
By all means.
you know, we could talk, like we said, evolution and physics and all sorts of stuff. But in many ways, what you need to know about the creation, and this goes back to what I said, you know, God chose what things he wanted us to know. In many ways, everything you need to know about the creation, or the most important thing you need to know about the creation, is in the first few words. In the beginning, God.
Yes.
Right? And those four words is the key element. We need to understand that this begins and ends with God, and there are tons of exciting and wonderful things to study. The symbols, ancient Near Eastern symbols, evolution, geology, whatever you want to study. But remember, it begins and it ends with God. It is his plan that he has put into place to exalt us, to bring us home to be with him in a higher, holier state. And that's the part that we can't forget.
No, exactly, to bring about that's his work and his glory.
Yeah.
And I would just add to that, Bruce and Marie Hafen have pointed this out, that the Adam and Eve are, where the humankind comes into this, and it's they're who we encounter in the endowment in the temple, and the story of their creation, fall, and redemption is the story of our creation and fall and redemption as married couples and as families. And again, at the center of all of it is Jesus Christ, as as Carrie so nicely pointed out earlier, by my word, when Moses asked how, by what was this creation carried out, it's all through Jesus Christ. His creating, but his redeeming us from the fall. He's the Redeemer, and it all revolves around him.
Indeed, without him, we don't have anything.
Absolutely.
This has been the Interpreter Show. I'd like to thank Matt and Carrie.
You're listening
we'll see
to
you next
Talk
week.
Radio,
thank you.
KBJA 1640 AM.